Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're blessed by the presence of Noah Kalos, founder of the groundbreaking YouTube and social media channels MycoLyco. This work is a blend of his passions for nature, mycology, and electronic music. He originally got hooked on electronic music production at the age of 17, but in the past 6 years, Noah took that passion to the next level, getting deep into digital music hardware and electrical engineering. Noah majored in studio art at Oberlin College and then spent 5+ years living in the wilds, transitioning between outdoor roles as a camp counselor and working in wilderness therapy. During his time in the wilds, he became familiar with all kinds of wild foods and has been a longtime mycology enthusiast. In the wake of the pandemic, Noah decided to focus on growing mushrooms. His plan was to convert his music studio into a mycology lab, but after a fateful connection between mycelium and synth electrodes, the studio and the lab became one in the same. Now with his MycoLyco project, Noah has been giving us all a window into the incredible musical frequencies of fungi. Noah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. I was telling you before the show, my wife and I are obsessed with the synthesized beats that you are drawing out of the fungi. And I want to talk about all your experience in the outdoors, obviously then your experience with electronic music and what is happening when we're hearing synths play mushroom sounds. But before we get into it, I think you have a really interesting backstory. So what are some of the key events that led you, you know, down this path into nature and becoming passionate about mushrooms? And how did that come together with your passion for electronic music?
Ooh, wow. So there's a lot of things. So I've been playing music since I was a child. I think as soon as I saw a piano, I just started playing away. I've never had piano lessons, but I'm self-taught in the piano. I have had lessons in trumpet and bass and guitar and upright bass. So music-wise, you know, it was kind of just a natural progression to get to electronic music. I started when I was 17. I took a summer course at Berklee College of Music for upright jazz bass and took an elective in electronic music production. And from there, I was hooked, and I was mostly working like digitally in the computer until about 6 years ago when I started using hardware that's a blend of analog and digital technology. So that's kind of like the quick version of the music side of things.
Yeah.
I worked for a modular synth company for 3.5 years or so called Make Noise, which we can get into maybe modular synths and stuff a little later. So on the nature side of things, I think that really started just as a kid going to summer camp, going hiking. And then from there, I ended up working at the summer camp. I hiked the Long Trail 1 year. Then the next year, I hiked the Appalachian Trail. I don't want to say that I through hiked it because people get very particular about what through hiking is. I hiked 1,900 miles of at the time was 2,175. So we skipped a little bit here and there, but we were on the trail for 6.5 months and had a blast. And then from there, I worked in nature after graduating from Oberlin College for a few years as a wilderness therapy field instructor.
I was really interested in that work because this idea of spending time in nature as being therapeutic is something I talk about a lot on the show, and I think resonates with a lot of people. It's one of the reasons I know a lot of people get into foraging. It's kind of this walking meditation and this therapy of being, you know, one with the natural world in a way. So what was that like? I mean, what is it to work at a wilderness therapy center? And then I know you worked in mental health as well. I guess in your opinion, with your experience, what are the ways that that time in nature, which I think it's safe to say you earned your stripes, you know, walking the Appalachian Trail, whether through hiking or not, you definitely spend a lot of time in the wild. How does that connection with nature help our mental health?
I think for me, one of the biggest things is just there being a disconnect from technology. I am so happy that I through hiked the Appalachian Trail back in 2006 before smartphones were a thing. Because
right.
Since I've been on the trail, I've seen some people and you get to the shelter and everyone has their smartphone out, checking their Insta and all that. And I think one of the great things about being in nature is actually being able to disconnect, turn your phone off, turn your computer off, get away from the technology, especially with all the social media I've been doing now. I admit I am very, very addicted to the technology. And it's great to put down, get away, have some mental space. breathe in the fresh air. So that's just like, that's like level one. That's the very basic level. But just being able to be yourself, be in your own body, become aware that you are a person in a landscape and not be focused on all these external distractions that we constantly have. And that just brings a certain amount of mindfulness that you can't really find in other places. And then from there, once you go from like just being in the woods for a few hours, once you're out there, because the wilderness therapy program I worked with, kids would be there for months at a time. I would be there for 8 days at a time. It becomes a lesson about self-reliance, about knowing yourself and your body and your surroundings and awareness of what you need to be alive. Just the basic knowledge and understanding of, oh, it's raining. I need to do something about that. It's getting cold. I should put on more clothing. These are things that we oftentimes forget about. I mean, we obviously put on a coat if it gets cold, but we're not making sure that we're putting on enough clothing because we know that there's going to be a house we can get inside of, or a hot cup of a tea, a warm shower. If our clothes get wet, we can throw them in a dryer, all those things. And when you strip that away and you're just out there in the woods with whatever supplies you can fit on your back, it creates sort of a different paradigm, a different reality, something that is very different than the society that we normally live in, especially for kids that have, you know, gotten into some trouble and have maybe been, you know, in a state of constantly fighting, where they're just fighting authority and fighting everything that's coming at them, whether it's through trauma or from trauma or anything like that, taking them out and putting them in a completely, so I'm getting choked up a little bit. I don't know why, but putting them, I haven't really talked about my work as a wilderness therapy for a long time. And it was hard work. It was the hardest work I've probably ever done in my life.
Well, and I appreciate your reaction because it gives us a sense of how powerful and how visceral this work is. And I think, you know, a lot of us get a small glimpse at that kind of clarity and that kind of healing that comes with being out in nature. I mean, it sounds like just getting outside of excessive civilization lets you tap back into your instincts. And my wife and I call it, you know, getting back into the body. Like you said, you remember that you're a human being in a body and what all these senses are for, and become a little more in tune with them. And I think the fact that you're reacting like you are just shows how powerful that is to watch that happen, especially for people who really need that kind of help.
Yep. Yeah. And just, I think the big thing is it's putting them in a new environment with new situations, and it allows them to take a step back from their life and to really reassess what's important, you know, and what sort of fights they've been having and whether those are necessary or not.
Yeah. Perspective. I mean, perspective on what's actually important and what's kind of unnatural pressure situations that we're forced into society.
Yeah. And I mean, the program, definitely there's some kids that the program wasn't for. Some kids did better than others, but there were just some absolutely amazing transformations that I saw in behavior. If any of you are listening, I'm so proud of all of you. I had probably thousands of students in my 3 years there. So.
Wow. So you got to impact a lot of lives. And I know you said you weren't working as a therapist per se. So what was your role when you were working in wilderness therapy?
We had a basic program where, I shouldn't call them kids, the teenagers. Well, I worked with a couple of different groups, ages from 11 to 17. There was various tasks that they would have to do, like building traps, learning how to build deadfall traps. We didn't actually catch anything. I'm learning how to start fires with a quartz rock and a piece of steel. And then later they learn how to bow drill fires, you know, set up a tarp. The basic skills like that. And they had to progress through the program learning those skills, which learning how to bow drill can take 2 months. I mean, there's some kids that took a really long time to learn, and 2 months isn't even that long. So teaching those basic wilderness skills, just being there, you know, hiking. We hiked every day, helping set up camp, basic stuff like that. And then there was like soft skills that we worked on too. A lot of like identifying feelings and the reasons behind that. A lot of like I feel statements, and being able to separate the difference between thoughts and feelings, and to sort of get some basic awareness and some basic like cognitive behavioral therapy stuff. Towards the end of my time there, we developed an education program so the kids could get some school credit when they were there. So I also taught some like basic geology and basic biology and stuff, you know, things about invasive species and all that sort of stuff. So it was quite the job, everything from science education to wilderness survival skills to some soft skills and communication skills. It was a trip. It was a very intense part of my life.
Well, it sounds like you ended up learning a lot, I'm sure, from your experience. I mean, how did that change who you were and your trajectory at that time?
I mean, I had graduated from school hoping to be an artist, which I guess now I maybe finally am. You know, I think that period of my life was definitely one of the most in tune periods I've ever felt with nature. Definitely felt more connected than I had in a while. When I stopped working there, I was kind of so sick of being in the woods and living in the woods that I didn't go camping for a while, which is kind of a shame. I wish I had gone camping more. Because now I have two kids, so it's harder to do it.
Right.
Yeah, like just a deep connection with nature. Really, you know, I was spent more than half the year out in the woods when I was working. So I've spent a total of 5 years in the woods between that and the Appalachian Trail and all the camp council learning I've done and all of that. And it's a part of my life that I miss. I need to get back out in the woods and spend a week in the woods. Real life takes over as soon as you have to work a day job and all that.
Right. We lose some of that vital connection.
Yep.
And what was the name of the organization? Only because I'm so struck by this work, and it's something that I've told guests before. You know, I wish there was some kind of rewilding or connection with nature as a formalized kind of therapy. So to hear that there is, and you've worked with it, is really inspiring. What was the name of the group?
A particular place that I was working with was called SUS, which used to stand for the School of Urban and Lunar Survival. But there's actually hundreds, if not thousands, of these programs all over the country. So there's a few in my area, out in the western North Carolina, Georgia area. There's a whole bunch out west. They are somewhat controversial. They are somewhat controversial because a lot of the time the kids don't want to be there and are there against their will, which is hard. That's very difficult. It's an awkward situation for sure. Been some young adults that felt like their rights weren't being respected by being held there. I feel like I did a lot of good work there. I also have some mixed feelings about that time in my life. But I think for the most part, the impact was positive.
Really intriguing. Obviously, add on that layer of navigating people's kind of individual sovereignty. And I can't imagine some of the stuff you're having to wrestle with.
Oh, yeah.
But it sounds like for you, it really got you more in tune with nature. But it was interesting when we were talking before the show, it wasn't necessarily your door to become obsessed with mushrooms, right? I mean, what kind of relationship did you develop with wild foods and were mushrooms part of that mix?
Yeah. So, you know, the kids weren't allowed to harvest wild edibles there for liability issues. But myself, I would definitely keep track of them and pick some when the kids weren't looking and maybe make myself some tea in the morning. I remember there was one week where I found over 30 different wild edible plants, which now I can't even remember that many. I was so good back then. I've like forgotten a lot of it. But yeah, back then I was kind of afraid of mushrooms. I would see reishi and stuff, but I never harvested any mushrooms just because there's, even 5 years ago, there was a lot more of a stigma against harvesting mushrooms. And I mean, most people within sort of the wilderness survival or foraging community would be like, oh no, stay away from mushrooms unless you're like an absolute expert, know
right.
100% what you're looking at. Don't even touch it. You know, you could touch it and that could be bad, which I know now you can touch anything, you're fine. But I had a lot of confidence about wild plants because in North Carolina, at least, there's some plants that'll make you sick, but there's really only one that will kill you, and that's poison hemlock. So as long as you're careful with that, this is not advice to anyone, don't go eating stuff. What I mean to say is it won't kill you. You might get very ill and end up in the hospital, but as far as I know, poison hemlock is the only thing in North Carolina that can kill you in small quantities. Large quantities of other things obviously still kill you. Where like mushrooms, you know, you hear, like, oh, one mushroom, and then like you can eat it and not know, and then die 2 weeks later of liver failure. It was really terrifying for me at the time. And I still am pretty careful.
Yeah.
I mostly just go for, I mean, reishi are easy. I'll go for reishi all day long. There's some cinnabar chanterelles that I know that grow in one's patch that I harvest in the same spot every year. And then, you know, oyster mushrooms, I haven't actually harvested even a wild oyster mushroom yet, but since I've been growing them, I'm feeling more confident about that.
And it's interesting just to highlight this kind of pervasive mycophobia that even in the wilderness community, and you were neck deep in the wilderness community, and still there's a hesitation around mushrooms. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's starting to shift.
Yeah.
Hopefully this shift won't result in any deaths, but it is shifting. I have like a friend that just got into mushroom foraging. They just got into mushrooms like over the pandemic, bought a book, and the next thing I knew, they were eating honey mushrooms, which I'm still dubious. I don't feel confident in my ability to identify honey mushrooms yet. So they were fine. They were honey mushrooms. They were alive. Everything's good.
Before you got into, you know, this program and being a camp counselor, did you have, you know, wilderness skills that you developed over the course of your lifetime, or was most of this taught to you in the context of trainers preparing you for this? Where did you acquire your wilderness skills?
I went to a summer camp called Farm and Wilderness, which Farm and Wilderness is the dearest place in my heart. I love that place more than anywhere else in the world. Absolutely life-changing for me going there. I think my first year there was when I was 12. I went from 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and then I was there working 18, 19, and then when I was like 21 and 22. I hope one day that I might get a chance to go back and off there again. And they weren't open this summer, so it's a Quaker camp, and I think that that's really where my connection with nature started. We did silent meeting every day for 15 minutes and then an hour on Sundays, and that was outside. At one camp, it was like in a meeting circle, but it was still a nice view. At the other camp, we would just pick a random spot in the woods every day and go sit there as a community for 15 minutes in silence. And that was an incredibly powerful experience to do every day, and I love it. I wish I could meditate more in my life now because my mind is just all over the place recently.
Well, and it sounds like meditation, and I'm not too familiar with Quaker culture. Was that something that you were kind of raised around? You know, was your family Quaker or anything like that?
No, I was raised Jewish, but I did go to this Quaker camp starting at age 12. And I think I first learned meditation at that camp. A lot of people took that as a time to meditate. Within the Quaker religion, I think you just kind of sit. And if you feel moved by the spirit to speak, you're allowed to speak. So sometimes people would speak. But it's just kind of a time to connect with divinity, however it is that you wish to do that, which is a wonderful thing in my opinion. Going to those camps is where I first started to learn wild edibles and wilderness survival skills and all that. And then working there, I taught them and I was pretty good. And then when I started working at Sue's, I got really, I don't want to brag or anything, but I got pretty good at bow drilling. I think my record for bow drilling a pole was about 6 seconds, which is, if you've ever bow drilled, that's a thing.
Well, and I think it's worth tooting your own horn about bow drilling, because it might look easy on wilderness survival shows when Bear Grylls does it, but it's a lot harder than that in real life.
Oh yeah, Bear Grylls don't have anything on me.
6 seconds, maybe a world record. Well then, as you're becoming this like wilderness, the next Bear Grylls or better than Bear Grylls, when did you start getting really interested in mushrooms? Because I know that you eventually even got into, you know, cordyceps and really started cultivating mushrooms. When did that happen for you?
Towards the end of my time working for a wilderness therapy program, me and my fiance, now wife at the time, we bought a house out in the country on 2 acres of land. And that's kind of, we started, you know, I had read this Seth Holzer book around then, and I got like real deep into permaculture, and from permaculture it wasn't very far to go into mushrooms. So I started 9 years ago starting to do some like just oyster beds outside, where I would just like, you know, buy some oyster mycelium sawdust spawn and mix it in with some straw and put it outside and hope for the best. And it didn't get contaminated or anything, but it didn't do great ever. I'd get like a handful of mushrooms and be like, oh my God, look at all these mushrooms. This is incredible. They taste so good. And I think it was then that I was like, oh wow, mushrooms at the grocery store taste terrible. This is why I don't like mushrooms. These are delicious. So that first taste of like blue oyster mushrooms that I grew just on some straw in my backyard was kind of the beginning. And then I grew some reishi just because it was a cool thing to do. You could grow it in like the tubs and have it get all the antlers and all. And did some lion's mane. And then I got into like doing my own grain spawn and all that sort of stuff. But it was like something like maybe I would bust out my crappy still air box and my like Presto pressure cooker, make some grain spawn and do like a couple bags, and like maybe they'd get contaminated, maybe they wouldn't. You know, and I'd eat some mushrooms and then I'd put it all away and wouldn't really think about it for a couple months, and then, you know, make another batch of oyster mushrooms, and that would be that. Until the pandemic hit. And that's when things kind of changed a little bit. And I started to take it a little bit more seriously and dive a little deeper even, especially with the cordyceps world, which my wife started taking cordyceps, and they aren't cheap. cordyceps. So I was like, oh, I can grow mushrooms. Like, sure, you want cordyceps? I'll just grow cordyceps. That's no problem. I grow oyster mushrooms and reishi all the time. Whatever. So then I started doing research and learned out that it was maybe a little bit more challenging. But I got on the Facebook group. There's this Facebook cordyceps cultivation group. If anyone is trying to learn how to grow cordyceps, that is the place to go. William, is his last name William Patel? I feel like I'm mispronouncing.
William Padilla Brown. Yeah.
Padilla Brown, that's it, not Patel. He's on there. I got both his books, although I haven't read the second one yet. Ryan Paul Gates is on there. And Ryan Paul Gates is, we actually met playing music at a show back 7 years ago. And we've been friends on Facebook ever since. So when I saw he was the cordyceps guy, I was like, oh, wow, cool. This is perfect.
What a cool synchronicity.
Yeah. And then Jeff from Appalachian Gold is on there as well. And those are all great sources for culture and great sources for advice. I think the thing with growing cordyceps, the most important thing is having a good culture source. If you just go to some like random website that's not specifically about cordyceps and you buy their culture and try and grow cordyceps, you're going to have a rough time. So my wife was eating cordyceps and I said that I'd try and grow some and started growing cordyceps. And then I like was looking at the price tag of cordyceps and thinking like, maybe I could start this business that would sell cordyceps. Dried cordyceps. And then I hit some snags with the whole like drying mushrooms and being able to sell them if you dry them in your house, because technically you need to dry them in like a facility.
Yeah, all the red tape comes in.
And I was like, okay, well, I'll just do some mushroom blocks to sell, like ready to fruit kits, because that I can do in a spare bedroom, no problem. People are just growing their own food. And that's when Michael Lyko was born. And I was thinking I might sell some tincture too, because there are tons of people selling tincture on Etsy. But yeah, so I like brainstormed for like a good 2 weeks coming up with a name for this like store. I was going to sell it at an Etsy shop. My wife runs a crystal Etsy shop, and she's very successful at that. She's great at the Etsy. So I was thinking she could help me out with that. It's around then when I was like, well, I should start doing some social media stuff for all this. You know, I'm not ready to sell anything yet. You know, it's Christmas and my wife's super busy and all that.
Yeah, well, you got to build the hype train.
And I knew about this module, the Instro Zion, which would let you connect mushrooms to synthesizers. And after working in wilderness therapy, you know, I worked a couple odd jobs working in a restaurant. But eventually, I ended up working for Make Noise, which is a modular synthesizer company, after, you know, getting deep into the modular synthesizer. So I had all these synthesizers around. It was just the next step. I couldn't find one anywhere. And luckily my friend, Brennan Power, was kind enough to sell me one of his because he has two. And I made a couple of videos and they started popping off on TikTok and then they started popping off on YouTube and Facebook. And it's been a pretty wild ride ever since.
The legend was born when those synthesizer electrodes got hooked up to a mushroom. And for anyone who's seen it, it's incredibly entrancing just to hear the frequencies coming out of these life forms. And, you know, I think a lot of folks have seen versions of this. I know there is the plant wave, which I believe is kind of a prepackaged synthesizer similar to what you use, obviously smaller size, a little more user-friendly for the mass market. But if you can give us an overview at the most basic level, what's happening when you're hooking that synthesizer up to a mushroom, you know, a plant, or really whatever object you're hooking it up to, and it starts emitting sound. You know, as best as you know, what's happening in that process?
Yeah, sure. So the plant wave or the Instro Zion, they both use the same circuit. They're both based off the MIDI sprout, which was open source. So they're both using the same circuit, which is using a 555 timer, which is basically sending like a square wave out of the output, but into the mushrooms is going like this little thin wave. But the mushrooms are literally becoming a resistor in the circuit. So what that means is that changes in resistance of the mushroom are going to cause the oscillator to change frequency. So we're not actually listening to the direct output of that oscillator. I think there are some devices, I'm blanking on his name right now. I'm blanking on everyone's name. The guy that Michael Prime is the guy. He's been doing this for a while. He has a device that was custom built for him. A little bit more of a raw signal from the mushroom, just kind of that oscillator click. What my device does is it then takes that frequency coming in and it digitally interprets it, which is the same thing that the plant wave does. And then the plant wave would convert that into MIDI data that it spits out, which you can then connect with like a cell phone or any sort of synthesizer, where mine spits out gate signals and control voltages. which are used for a modular synth, which is a little bit more free. Because with the plant wave, you're kind of restricted to just these signals initiating notes and changing the pitch of them, which is awesome. You can, that's probably a more accurate picture of what's going on with the mushroom, but it doesn't have as many dimensions to it. So what I've started doing is, instead of just the pitch, I also have it affect the timbre through things like frequency modulation, and I have it affect the filter cutoff, the filter frequency, various effects on the delay and the reverb, which allows the mushroom to not only just control what notes and when it's playing them, but how those, what those sounds are as well.
And all that information is encoded in the wave that it's putting back as it completes the circuit. And make sure I'm understanding, you're putting this square wave into the mushroom, it becomes the resistor. And then is it transforming that original wave, or is it putting out a response back through the...
Yeah, so in a basic oscillator circuit, what you have is you have a capacitor that's charging up and then discharging. And the rate that it charges up affects how fast that oscillator is going.
Got it.
And that rate is determined by the resistance of the resistor going into that capacitor. I mean, obviously there's a million architectures for oscillators, but this is a very common one.
Yeah.
And so if the resistance increases in the mushrooms, the wave that's going into them or going through them is going to slow down. If the resistance goes down, it will speed up. And then that output is sent into a digital board that then interprets it and converts it into usable controls for the synthesizer. But I do have an output on my my device that I could just listen into those square waves directly if I wanted to. And believe it or not, I've had this device for, I think I got it in October, the Instrozyne. I've had the whole modular synth for a while. I haven't actually used that output yet. I need to check it out. Maybe I'll go do that after this. I'm like thinking about it. I'm like, why haven't I actually ever looked at that output? I guess just because I've been so excited with everything else. There's just so much to explore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it seems like the possibilities are endless. The different species you could try out. I'm sure there's a lot of modulations you can do on the synth. But just to understand again that difference between your system and the plant wave. So the wave that the mushroom is, you know, sending back basically through resistance, it has encoded within it not only the notes to play, but how to affect things like reverb. That doesn't seem possible. It's mind-blowing.
And the Instrozyne, which is the device I'm using, and the plant wave work the same way, sending that wave through there. The output, so you just have basically going through the mushrooms, it's like a thin wave because of where it is in the circuit. And that's just speeding up and slowing down. And then that is going into a digital chip with code on it that's reading the frequency. So it's paying attention to how fast it's going or how slow it's going. And then it's assigning a value based on that. So with the plant wave, it would be assigning a MIDI note and, you know, when it turns on and when it turns off based on, you know, when there are sudden changes in the resistance is how it initiates notes. Where with my device, it's just converting it into sort of raw voltages that I can then plug anywhere I want in the synthesizer.
I mean, that's incredible. And it just gets to this idea that frequency and sound really contains so much information.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, to me, I find it far more interesting to give the mushrooms a wider sonic universe to play in.
Yeah.
So that they have the ability to change the actual sound itself rather than just what notes it is. And I feel like that creates something that allows you to get a little bit more in tune with them and to sort of feel what they're expressing just a little bit more.
I guess what I want to know, because you've obviously done other objects that you've hooked the electrodes up to, done this similar process, letting crystals, you know, let a wave pass through them and then encode musical information in there. How are mushrooms different? Do they have any unique signature in terms of what kind of music they end up playing with your system?
Mushrooms are way more active. People might take that the wrong way. They just have a lot more bioelectric activity in them than other things. There's been a lot of research on the fact that they have like these rhythmic spiking behaviors to them and that they respond to like touch stimulus and a whole bunch of stimulus. There's a lot more going on. I think a lot of it has to do with like how fast they're growing compared to say like a cactus. I've done some cactus and those are like pretty slow and mellow in comparison. And then an orchid's kind of like maybe somewhere in between. Oyster mushrooms are crazy, you know. Cordyceps are a little bit more chill. But definitely like oyster mushrooms, like I've had different patches that should sound very different, and I'm surprised that they still sound so similar. The oyster mushrooms definitely seem to have some sort of like characteristic sound pattern when they get hooked up. The crystals, I don't know about the crystals. Some of my fans are going to hate me for saying this, but I've explicitly stated in a lot of the videos that I have no way of knowing whether it's just picking up Wi-Fi or not, because, you know, you need something that's conductive, and so I can't just clip the electrodes onto the crystal and get anything out. So I'm putting a copper wire around them, which is, it's like an antenna, so it could just be picking up Wi-Fi. What I like to think, at least, what I tell myself, is that it's an interaction between sort of the ambient electromagnetic fields and the crystal, because moving the crystal or changing the crystal or even putting other crystals around it do have an effect on the signal coming out. I don't know that glass wouldn't do the exact same thing, but I like to think that there is at least a small difference between the crystals and glass. And it's that small difference that I hope people can find beauty in.
That small difference is where the magic is. One of my questions was in the stimuli you can provide that might manipulate the reaction. Because, you know, when I first think of it, it's like, well, is that wave passing through, in this case, you know, the mushroom, the mycelium organism, going to be the same no matter what's happening? Or let's say, yeah, you touch the mycelium block, or, I mean, God forbid you even cut it or, you know, provoke it somehow. Does that change the feedback then that you get?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's absolutely a reaction to touching it. There's a lot of reasons for that. One is that you're just touching it, so all of a sudden your capacitance from your body is going to be involved in the waveform. So it's going to be going into you. But the thing there is, even after you touch it, there is a response for a few seconds afterwards as the mushrooms are actually responding with an electrical signal to the touch. And then there was like one video where I was harvesting cordyceps in a tub, and I wore gloves to try and insulate myself as electrically as possible, although they're thin gloves, and there's still going to be some capacitance issues with that. But absolutely, touching them, spraying water on them. I creeped myself out once. I was doing this live stream on TikTok where I had some cordyceps hooked up, and I was like putting crystals around them, and they were like changing when I moved the crystals around them, and then like put some other plants. And then someone was like, sing to it. And I'm like, I'm not going to sing on a live stream on a public platform. I will sing my children to sleep. I might sing before meals at Farm and Wilderness, but I'm not going to sing on TikTok. But I was like, but I do, as cliche as this is, I do happen to play the Native American flute. I'll play some Native American flute for them. And they absolutely responded to it. I should really make a video of that at some point, but it kind of creeped me out, so I haven't done it again yet. And like, I was like, is it just me playing the flute that it sounds different because I'm like playing the flute at the same time? Or did, and people are like, no, they responded. They changed what they were doing when you played the flute. And I was like, okay, that's weird. I don't know if it's just like vibrations being picked up on the table that they're on, or like, or they're vibrating, or like what's going on really. But, you know, and I'm sure there's going to be some people that are like, no, they wouldn't do that. But this isn't science, it's art. So in my opinion, yeah, they absolutely responded to the flute.
I mean, that just changes the game potentially, because so many of the mysteries around mushrooms, I think one of the biggest burning questions is, how is information transmitted along mushroom mycelium? You know, when you have a mycelium block and you touch it, how does the rest of the mycelium somehow know what's happening over there? As Merlin Sheldrake put it, you know, they're processing information everywhere at once, but nowhere in particular at the same time. And this kind of work with passing frequencies through it, I think, illustrates it in a more visceral way than almost anything else could. And I've always loved the idea of the sentience or the consciousness in mushrooms. We always think of brains as being the seat of consciousness. I know there are folks that say the analogy between mycelium and brain doesn't really fit, but I think there is something there that we just don't quite understand. And I think their response to your Native American flute playing really peels up the edge around that mystery.
Oh yeah, absolutely. People should talk to their plants, talk to their mushrooms. I don't know if they'll understand you, but at this point, I have no doubt that they can hear you.
I mean, we have proof they respond to the stimuli. Well, what questions for you as someone who's kind of what I'm going to call like a pioneering field of vibrational or frequency science with living organisms? What are some of the questions you have? I know you said this is art, so maybe it's more art than science, but are there kind of like experiments or scenarios you want to play with more to try to satisfy your own curiosity?
Yeah, I definitely have some ideas. Like, I want to bring the mushrooms outside at some point. I mean, obviously, I want to go outside and find wild mushrooms once it's the right weather here.
Yeah, of course.
I bought a battery pack so I can bring my synth outside, but I also want to, like, do some videos where I bring the mushrooms outside and see if that changes things. Maybe try some different blocks, like a block spaced 5 feet apart from each other, and then put an electrode on each one and see if there's any sort of communication between them. One thing I've been noticing is that some of my mushroom blocks, even if I started them at totally different times, and like one's a first flush and one's a second flush, seem to flush at the same time. And it's not like environmental, because it's like in a stable environment inside next to a humidifier. So I wonder if they're not somehow communicating through the air, or just like able to sense tiny little fluctuations in electricity through like the countertop they're on. I don't know. That's one thing I've been thinking about. I want to do some agar dishes at some point, just because I have some old cordyceps agar that's sitting around that's not good for anything. I did a video today that I just posted of like an old pink oyster mushroom that, like, honestly, we all thought we might be getting COVID because it was dropping so many spores in the house, and we all got kind of allergic to it. Yeah, I'd been waiting around to make a video with it and didn't get around to it, and I should have harvested it. But I made a video at like 3 a.m. last night because I figured out what was going on while we were all feeling sick. People growing mushrooms, if they get old, make sure to harvest your oyster mushrooms before they get all old, because you don't want them in your house. I did that, and then I'm gonna keep the patch exactly the same and plug in one that's a little bit younger that also needs to be harvested. I'm trying to give my mushrooms away to my friends at this point because I have so many. That's one experiment I want to do. I have plans to try and make playlists and categorize, like give each patch a name before I change it, so that people can know that, like, oh, these 5 videos are all the same patch. And unfortunately, I haven't done a good enough job at this point keeping track of what's what to do that. But I think from here on out, I'm going to try and do a better job of that, just so that people that do want to kind of compare and contrast will have a better basis to do it. Because I repatch once every week or two to do something different to keep it exciting for me. I like to imagine each patch as a sonic universe. And it used to be, before I had the mushrooms, that I would be sitting at the control center steering through the sonic universe. Because once you have the patch going, I mean, you can take a single patch, you can make a techno song on it, you can make like an ambient thing, you can make a totally abstract, weird thing without having to change any of the cables at all. So by giving the mushrooms the freedom to do that within a certain extent, I feel like I'm allowing them to sort of explore a new universe that they were never able to explore again. With the knowledge that they probably can hear what they're doing, it's kind of like, at this point, I almost feel bad about harvesting mushrooms if I haven't hooked them up to the synthesizer, especially if they've like been in the room with other mushrooms and the other mushrooms have been hooked up. I feel like it's just not fair to them.
They haven't gotten their chance to express their musical talents. And just so I'm clear, what do you mean by when you reference a patch?
Right. So a patch. So if you look at the synthesizer, there's all these crazy cables everywhere.
Yeah.
That's routing all of the signals around. So I have, from the mushrooms, I get 4 CV signals and 4 gate signals. And I normally will split those 4 CV signals into 4 more. So I have like 16 different CV sources. 4 of them are copies of each other. You know, there's like 4 different ones. But I'll send those to various things around the synth to control the synthesizer. So depending on the configuration of those wires, that's what is considered a patch. And that's sort of where the name came from originally, because you were on a modular synthesizer, you're physically patching it, like, you know, like a patch bay operator or like a phone operator or whatever. Now in your keyboard-based synthesizers, people still refer to the sound that's coming out as a patch, because you can, you know, edit it within the menu and save it and recall it. Unfortunately, with the modular synthesizer, I can't do that. So it's not like I can come back to a patch that I had. I mean, I guess I could write it down really meticulously and keep track of it. And some people do that.
Right.
Maybe one day I'll do that.
Maybe when you get to that level of almost scientific analysis, you can figure out what patch elicits what response out of what mushroom.
Yeah. Or like when my kids are in college.
Yeah, when you've got more time for it. Who knows?
Yeah. But I'm no longer on unemployment due to the YouTube and the TikTok.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah. I can't apply for unemployment anymore. I'm doing very, very well currently. I mean, I just turned on the YouTube ads like 3 days ago, so I can't guarantee that this is going to be what I'll be able to do for... No, I'm not ever going to have a day job. This is what I'm doing for the rest of my life, yeah. Probably.
I mean, you're hinting at some really exciting potentials about like mushroom co-regulation. You know, that's even a cutting edge field of research on humans with kind of the magnetic field around our bodies and how that changes them around other people. So you're hinting at, you know, those possibilities with mushrooms, possibilities how different individuals maybe within the same species express themselves differently. And I love how you just referenced the mushrooms' potential to hear themselves playing music. And then how does that influence? Yeah, that's really some deep questions you're getting at, I think, in ways that you can't get at theoretically. You know, having this audio response gives you a lot more insight. What has the reaction been? I mean, have you been reached out to yet by, you know, mycologists, or has there been like any outreach from the scientific community to explore this thing deeper at this point?
Not really. No, I don't really think I'll have any scientists reaching out to me, just because there's research on the electrical activity of mushrooms that's out there.
Right.
And there's much better ways to do the research where you can hook up something that'll just monitor the resistance and plot it on a graph or something like that.
Got it.
Where, you know, if you wanted to actually study it and look at it and try and derive some sort of meaning from it on a scientific level, that probably would be easier to analyze than just the sound. Although with technology that we have coming, there might be some possibilities for more analysis with artificial neural networks. I would love to imagine you could start analyzing it with artificial neural networks. And I think it would be a fun art project to have someone try and create an artificial neural network to translate what the mushrooms are saying into English. I don't know what it would do. There's like a part of me that likes to pretend that in the future, people are going to be like listening to my videos and able to translate the messages of the mushrooms and like,
yeah,
you know, some crazy stuff like that. But that's probably just me being a wild guy. But I'd love to work with someone to do some artificial neural network stuff on it. I think that would be really interesting from an artistic and perhaps scientific perspective. But there definitely are probably better ways to analyze things without the music. But it might be really interesting to run both of those things at the same time, to be doing the music, biodata sonification, and see how that affects the data that they put out, like do without the music, with the music, with them playing the music, with them playing random music, playing music that other mushrooms made. You know, you could definitely do some cool stuff. My ability to analyze data in any sort of meaningful way is limited to the calculus that I've forgotten since college. So I'm definitely not the person to do that.
Right.
But there could be some really cool stuff to be done.
I think you're going to inspire a lot of interest in this vein of biosonification. I like that term. I think you're going to inspire a lot of people to get into this. I know that myself, my wife, pretty much anyone who watches it thinks I need that, what looks like an old phone bank, this modular synth in my life. I need to start connecting it to things, because it's just, I mean, it is like you're communicating with the mushroom. And something that I've seen you do, you know, maybe it's just for the sake of creating a story, the sake of the video, but you've had, you know, mushrooms talking to each other. So what does that mean? You know, we saw a pink oyster and a cordyceps talking to each other, and you had electrodes hooked up to each. What are you doing there when you have that going?
I'm just kind of bumping them up, mycelium to mycelium or fruiting body to fruiting body. Either way, it'll go through the mycelium.
Right.
So it's making them electrically connected, which means I can use my device on them. Or sometimes they'll just all be on the stainless steel table, which is connecting them electrically.
Okay.
But basically, I'm running a signal through all of them and getting the output of what's coming back. So, I mean, it's probably just them all talking all at once. So it's not like necessarily a conversation as much as just a cacophony of discussion. But,
right,
you know, there's been some pretty significant research that shows that mushrooms send communication signals across species of mushrooms and across different kingdoms as well. You know, I remember there's this Paul Stamets quote where he talks about the discovery of endophytic fungi. And that was something that for me was really groundbreaking and life-shattering when I first heard about that. I think I heard about it in 2006 or 2009. I feel like they discovered it in like 2009 or so. I can't remember the details, but I like used that soundbite in a song for many music projects ago, back before I was even a Illumination Station, my even previous music project, which doesn't need to be named. But yeah, I used that soundbite about Paul Stamets talking about the discovery of endophytic fungi and how they're in between cell walls and can mediate the nutrition and glucose levels between different species of trees in the forest. And to me, it's clear that the movie Avatar is real. you know, that there are electrical, chemical signals, maybe other signals that we don't even know about yet, being sent between the forests. That was life-changing for me. Also, realizing that our perspective that we've been taught about nature being the survival of the fittest is a lie.
Yes.
And we use that a lot to support and back up and justify the capitalist economic system.
Yeah, it ends up being a pretty central rationale for a lot of immorality that goes on.
Right, this whole survival of the fittest idea. But if you actually look at how nature works, it's not survival of the fittest. In fact, it's cooperation. I mean, even the predator-prey relationship, predators aren't going after the biggest prey. They're going after the young and the sick. And so it's a cooperation where both species are improving the other one's genetics throughout history. I mean, if you want to look on like on a historical scale, the predator-prey relationship is benefiting both species.
Mm.
Similarly, in the forest, it's if a tree gets too much sun, it's not like, "Ooh, I'm getting too much sun. You all are screwed." Nope. It's actually sending its glucose to other trees, other species to help everything else out.
And I think what you're elucidating beautifully is that idea of how a relationship with fungi, a relationship with mushrooms, really understanding them on that level, you know, the biochemical, potentially electrical, the signals they have, both mycorrhizal and endophytic fungi. It hints at this idea of how it changes narratives, how it even changes our human narrative. Because so much of the way we tell our stories and we organize as societies and as cultures are based around or rationalized by models of other organisms or natural forces. So I think we're entering this era of, you know, this massive appreciation for the mushroom. And I think this podcast, your incredible popularity with the music you're putting out are kind of symptoms of that, of our culture seeking out this other narrative or models because the ones we're using clearly aren't working. And fungi seem to offer answers in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think fungi are definitely going to be a part in changing and saving the world in so many different ways. There's so much innovation going on in the fungal world. I kind of want to try my hand at making some of that like mycelium leather. I don't know if you've seen that stuff.
That's super cool. Yeah.
There's just so much going on right now. And I think the hobby as a whole has like really blown up, especially since the pandemic. There's a lot more citizen science going on, which is really exciting. I don't know if I'm ready to call myself a citizen scientist yet, but maybe I am. And I think that stuff's really cool because, you know, I have a pretty, if you're an electrical engineer, I probably sound like I don't know what I'm talking about, but I have a pretty decent understanding of electrical engineering. And that's just stuff that I taught myself pretty much from some books and the internet. And with the internet these days, you know, you can really get as much education as you get out of a 4-year college program, just nerding out in your free time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know some people might disagree with that. And I think it's important that if you are trying to educate yourself, you do have a community that you're talking to. You have some mentors. You know, I had people in the DIY community that were helping me out. I had this NASA engineer that actually helped me build my first circuit. So it's important to have help from people, but you can find those people that like, they're just randomly the NASA engineer that's willing to help you out with your electrical engineering project because you met on a Facebook group. So I think that, you know, you don't need to go to college anymore. You know, it might help with some fields, specifically engineering and science, getting a job for a company. You might want to get a degree. But if you're just interested in doing your own research and doing your own thing, there's so much potential with the way that information is being shared these days.
Yeah, I think the model of college, you know, really applies in some places. I think some of the biggest benefits are kind of connecting with community, finding guidance. But as the internet matures, more and more, you know, you're able to find that through other avenues on the internet. You're able to find your tribe or community, if you will. You're able to get guidance on what you're really interested in and then able to bounce ideas around with people. And I think some of that is the most valuable parts of really going to college. So yeah, I have to agree that I think the internet, YouTube University is at this point making college a little obsolete in ways. But I guess, do you have advice for people who do want to start? You know, you told us about the Cordyceps group, which is that Cordyceps Facebook group is kind of the cutting edge on developing Cordyceps. But where can people go to learn more about synth and making some of these devices and kind of creating their own music?
Sure, sure. Oh, so first, I just want to clarify to any young kids listening, I am in no way saying don't go to college. I'm just saying that you don't need to go to college. Because when I was a kid, I was pretty much brainwashed to believe that I had to go to college.
Yeah.
Especially I grew up in like a suburban town. So anyways, I just want to clarify that because I don't want to discourage anyone.
To digress a little further on that point, my father was actually a university professor for like 30 years. And he was a big proponent for how it's more important to follow passion, what you're interested in, you know, and if that's a trade, it means you don't go to college, it's totally fine. It's more important to be following the lead of where your passion is, because that's going to yield the actual results in your life that you want to see. So yeah, we're not saying college is universally bad, but don't feel like you have to go. I like that clarification.
Yeah, and I guess I brought up the college thing just because a lot of people poo-poo on the citizen scientist being like, you're not a real scientist, you don't have a degree, blah, blah, blah. I was just making that point because there's a lot of citizen scientists in the mycology world, and you really can learn all this stuff without a degree. A degree is useful, but yeah.
Well, and mycologists in general, and I think this is because mushrooms are kind of dissident, professional academic mycologists in general love citizen science and really like think it's a critical part to moving mycology forward, because whether it's testing out the synth frequencies of different mushrooms or just cataloging biodiversity, it just takes manpower, and the citizen science community is kind of the most diverse, biggest group to collect observations that there is. So I'm always impressed by how much what you're saying is backed up by academic and scientific mycologists. And I think that's what makes mycology such an exciting, vibrant community, honestly.
Yeah, it's there's so many different ways to get involved in the mycology community that it's really a fun little community to be in.
Yeah.
Back to where to learn more about modular synthesizers.
Right.
The company that I used to work for called Make Noise, they have an excellent YouTube channel. Walker, the guy that makes all the videos, does a really good job about that. It's like a new language at first, so it can be intimidating. The O-Coast or the Zero-Coast or the No-Coast is Make Noise's kind of beginner patchable synthesizer. So checking out some videos on that is probably like a good way to sort of get introduced into what a patchable synthesizer might be like. Mm. Make Noise doesn't like to call it a semi-modular synthesizer, because some people use this term semi-modular for synthesizers that have some pre-routing to them, like the O-Coast or the Mother 32. Modular is kind of something that needs to be modular, not modular. Semi-modular is kind of a oxymoron, you know? So Make Noise calls it a patchable desktop synthesizer because it does have some automatic MIDI routing in it. So the O-Coast is cool because you could just plug in a MIDI keyboard and just start playing, or plug in like a plant wave and just have it start doing stuff. Mm. And just start turning knobs without having to patch any cables at all. So that's a really good starting point for getting involved. Then you can patch the cables and see what they do and all that. The Make Noise YouTube channel, I highly recommend. I like DivKid Ben on YouTube. He has a lot of videos, but he talks fast. I remember when I was first getting into modular, watching his videos, and he was like, LFO! EG, BCA, all really fast in his British accent. I had no idea what he was talking about. There's a couple books. There's a book called Patch Notes. I haven't looked through it that much, so I don't know how good that would be for beginners. Oh, obviously I should plug my Facebook group. I have a Facebook group that I started years ago called Eurorack Patch that is entirely about people learning how to patch Eurorack synthesizers.
Perfect.
So feel free to join that group, ask questions, get going. Yeah, there's, you know, maybe I'll make a tutorial for my current channel at some point just on the basics, because I used to give demos when I worked at Make Noise. So I've done it a million times, and I've done some Skype modular lessons in my day as well. Although I don't know if that would be too far out of my channel's paradigm to really...
Might be too off-brand.
Makes sense. Yeah, it might be too off-brand to do some tutorials, because there's so many. There's millions of synth tutorials on YouTube.
Yeah.
Andrew, it's either Huang or Huang. I know I always mispronounce it. He's like Andrew Is Music on the YouTube. He has like 2 million subscribers. He has some videos that I think are actually probably pretty beginner friendly, because he already had 1 million subscribers on YouTube when he first got into modular. He probably has some good tutorials on sort of how it all works, I bet, because he has a ton of videos. So those are some good places to look.
Yeah, so it sounds like join the Facebook group, Eurorack Facebook group. Go on YouTube. There's a vibrant community full of YouTubers ready to show you how this works, so we can kind of all dip our toes in the water and start playing with synth. I know that's high on my list for the new year, is to try to dip my toes in these waters, because watching your videos has been, I just love the concept of it so much. You know, what are any future plans for you? I know we just talked about your channel and I want to keep you on brand here, but what are some future plans or projects that you've got in mind? And that could be, you know, synth related or otherwise.
Sure. Well, I think I'm just going to keep going with this Michael Echo because it's being so successful. But I've got some Lion's Mane growing. So I'm going to do some Lion's Mane soon. I had a whole bunch growing that I just got a flow hood like a month or two ago, and the first set of stuff I did with the flow hood, even though I let it blow for a really long time, a lot of it got contaminated. Probably because I thought the flow hood was going to be some like magic sterile. I don't know.
Right, something that you think no protocol needed.
I just wasn't using as much alcohol as I normally did, and it seems like since I sprayed a lot more alcohol, things are doing good. So I want to do some lion's mane soon. I have some lion's mane in an agar jar that's like started to fruit in there that I might do because it's gorgeous, but I also like really love it and don't want to mess it up. And then that's from, I have a friend that works at Moog, and they had a lion's mane growing, Moog being the synth company. They had a lion's mane growing at their house, and that lion's mane is one that I cloned from that. So that's I'm working on bringing up that strain of lion's mane, and I'm excited to do some videos of that just because it grew next to someone that works at Moog's house, I guess. I don't know why that matters, but it's cool to me.
It's got some special residual energy inside of it. It's going to produce amazing sound.
Yeah, it's weird. I've been to Moog's house. It's weird. Like, I have friends that live at Moog's house now. I'm like, so connected into the Moog world, even though I worked at Make Noise, not Moog. Anywho.
Now, are those two companies kind of the Coke and Pepsi of the synth world?
They're just the two big synth companies in Nashville. But I don't know if you've ever checked out Ryan Paul Gates' strains, Terrestrial Fungi. People call it both. I never know which one to call it.
That's funny. You know, I swap my pronunciations between fungi and fungi. And yes, actually, we've had Ryan on for an interview, which should be airing, you know, pretty soon.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm going to get some of his reishi strains because his reishi, I don't know if you've seen his reishi. They're so gorgeous. I would love to have one of those and hook him up to the synth. We were actually chatting the other day, and he's trying to get himself a biodata sonification device to hook his reishi up to his synth stuff. And I told him about this guy on Tindy that was selling him, and literally as we were both like, yeah, maybe we should just, because I was like, maybe I should just pick up another one, just get a MIDI-based one to try that out. They went out of stock because I've been telling too many people about that guy.
You've been spreading the word.
Yeah, he's selling them for like $125, although it was 70 shipping, which is why I didn't check out right away. So the most 70 shipping from Germany is kind of steep, but on the market, that's the cheapest thing you can get that'll do the thing.
And what's that called again?
He has a website on Tindy. It's just a MIDI sprout clone. So if you just Google biodata sonification and Tindy, you'll find it. And now I'll never be able to get one because everyone will know about it.
Yeah, maybe we shouldn't put the word out, but it doesn't sound like you have to break the bank to start playing with this stuff.
No, I think it's great. I want more people to play with it. And maybe I should send that guy a message and be like, hey, you should probably build some extra ones because I think I'm sending some business your way.
And give Mike Olyko a referral code.
Yeah, that'd be nice. But that said, the whole project is open source, actually. I should send you a link for anyone that wants to get involved that's maybe handy with an Arduino. Because when I saw the $70 shipping, I was like, I'll just build one myself. I have an Arduino Uno sitting around. It's like an Arduino Uno, or you can do one without an Uno with a board and an Atmega 328P on it. But the easiest way is just to buy an Arduino Uno, get a breadboard, and you need like a 555 timer and a couple parts, and you can... The hardest thing is going to be compiling the code and putting it on the Arduino. And then besides that, you just have to wire it up. There's a GitHub that shows you how to do everything. And there's Instructables too, actually. And it's all by the guy that made the MIDI sprout, which then turned into PlantWave. So he's been really, I'm just very thankful to him that he put it out there as an open source project. Because that's what allowed the Instro Zion to be made, is because it was based off of that. Because that's definitely the cheapest way to get involved. I think you could probably build the whole thing. Minus, you know, the synthesizer that you're connecting to, probably for like $40, you know, in a couple hours of time.
I'm over here kind of nodding my head like I know everything you're talking about, but I'm excited to dive in and get familiar with this this new vocabulary. But it sounds like MIDI Sprout, and that link you're going to send over, some great places to start. And then where is the best place for people to find you and your work and interact with you? You know, folks listening, by the time this airs, are probably going to know about it because it's blown up so much. Where's the best place to find your work?
For longer content, YouTube, definitely. I'm going to be putting videos out. Recently, I've been putting them out every day. That's been going really well, but I'm not going to be able to keep that up forever because I'm going to run out of mushrooms. But at least a couple times a week. So YouTube for longer content. I have a Patreon that is actually now mostly just kind of crystal-based because there's some people really, really into the crystal. The people into the crystals are more into the crystals than I am. So if you want to get deep into some crystals, some long crystal meditation tracks, that's where I'm going to be putting the longest audio tracks. And I'll probably put some long mushroom tracks on there as well. So if you want to just like tune out to some things, the Patreon, it is $3.33 a month.
Oh, magic number 333.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, someone signed up for $33.33. So that was awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a nice little monthly chunk of change.
Yeah, getting some energy in for the great energy you're putting out there.
Short stuff, TikTok and Instagram. I'm on both of those. I just changed my Illumination Station page to Michael Lyko on Facebook. So if you want to dive deep into my synthesizer journey, the Facebook and the Instagram will take you deep, deep, deep into before I was even doing modular stuff on the Instagram, I think.
I really encourage people to check it out because tons of good content. It's something new that we don't generally get to see. And yeah, I like your videography work, honestly. The colors and having the board in there next to the mushrooms. There's something really, really cool about it.
Yeah, that whole thing kind of evolved in an interesting way. I mean, I went to college. As I mentioned college before, I did go to college. Right. I studied art in college. I was originally going to college to study music and science, which would have made more sense for what I'm doing right now, I guess. But I had some religious experiences during college and kind of decided that I was looking for the answers to the universe, wanted to know everything.
Aren't we all?
And I realized freshman year of college pretty quickly that the answers I was looking for I wouldn't find in science. Now, with all the crazy quantum physics stuff, maybe I could, but it didn't seem like what I was looking for was going to be there. Because it just seemed like the more you learn, the more crazy it gets, the more people don't actually know what's going on.
Right.
And so I decided to seek knowledge in a different way. And then started doing art as a way to do that. Explore the inner realms through, you know, I did a lot of abstract painting, and it was kind of like a thing about, like, as you paint, you're meditating and your emotions are changing and you reflect that in the painting, and the painting becomes like this record of your conscious thought in a way. Anyways.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's no surprise then that your aesthetic sense flows through you and into your video setup to transmit the frequencies of the fungi.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The whole, like, the stainless steel table and the flow hood in the back and all that. It works, and it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been originally trying to start a mushroom business, because I had that in there. And then the pink light that I use, I just added some other color lights too, but the pink light that I used, I originally had that in there because I was experimenting using that instead of white light for some of my cordyceps. Because cordyceps have a very interesting response to light. I actually stopped using that one because I swear it makes them grow shorter than without it.
So maybe not a good cordyceps grow light at this point, but a mystical ambiance light, absolutely.
Yeah, everything just kind of fell into place. It's crazy.
I love it. And again, I encourage people to go follow your work. Can't recommend it enough to people. And as we round things out, I'm going to move to some questions that I ask all my guests. And I can tell with your thoughtful insights, you'll probably have some great answers for us. And I'm excited for the first one, which is, what is a mushroom that you love and why? It doesn't have to, there's no pressure of a favorite, but a mushroom you love and why?
Yeah, I mean, right now I just love the pink oysters and the cordyceps. I just like the colors. They're just so pretty. They're beautiful. They're just such beautiful mushrooms. And, you know, they both have some pretty good medicinal benefits, and both of them are delicious when fried in butter and garlic. But I think I'm most drawn to them just because of the vibrant colors, and I love vibrant colors. What can I say?
Who doesn't love mushrooms of vibrant colors? And I guess to extend that question, what mushroom do you think sounds the coolest or the most pleasing to you?
Ooh, I think I like the cordyceps. I think that they're around for a little bit longer than the pink oysters, you know? Like, a cordyceps, they take like a month, or, well, they take like 60 days fully, but like once they start pinning, you've got like a good month before they're fully developed.
Right.
I just feel like they're in this world longer. I mean, I know the mycelium is sort of where the main organism is, but the actual fruiting body themselves kind of have a less impermanent existence, which somehow makes me feel like they're wiser.
Wiser, maybe more grounded, a little less frenetic than the mushrooms.
Yeah, I got to try some reishi because those stick around even longer.
I have a feeling we're going to kind of get a download of sage wisdom from the frequencies of the reishi.
Yeah.
Kind of a big general question. What has this relationship you've developed with mushrooms and fungi, and now this kind of intimate audio relationship with fungi, but what has that given to you? What's that brought to your life?
For me, it's like a constant reminder of the fact that there's stuff around us all the time that we cannot see. There is so much information encoded into every little speck of dust and every little thing that is just because of our perception and our scale, we are not aware of. And that when we take this information and we use it for something, you know, artistic and creative, that really magical stuff can start to happen.
Yeah, there's all kinds of invisible power all around us waiting to be tapped into. I really like that idea. I think fungi do illustrate that beautifully. And then finally, what's the lasting impact you hope to have with this work? And this doesn't have to be something really grand, but what's the lasting impact you hope to have with your work with Mike Oloko?
This is grand. And it's honestly, it's not my own idea, which is the amazing thing about this artwork, is that people have already brought ideas and stuff to it. Like meditating to it was not my idea. That was some random comment on TikTok. And I went with it. I'm like, oh, that's cool. Yeah, it's the whole thing. But I hope that it raises people's awareness of how alive plants are, and fungi and nature in general, maybe even the earth, that we like to think of these things as still and unmoving. Oh, that chicken's coming through. We like to think of these things as still and unmoving, but as soon as we tune into them in a different way, we can really see how they're alive. And I hope that maybe it helps people to respect nature more, and to realize that we need to protect our nature, and that we are caregivers to the land, and that that is a very important role for humanity to be trying to play right now.
And I think there's no stronger way you can do that than by giving nature and the organisms that live within it a voice. You know, I know for me, just listening to your videos makes me look at mushrooms differently. You know, just hearing that sound they're emitting gives you a different perspective. So I definitely think you're doing that. And Noah, thank you so much for coming on the Mushroom Hour and sharing your art and sharing your whole story. You've been really open, and I'm excited to see where it leads, because I think it's fun and exciting work. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. Thank you.